The DfE's report on teacher workload leaked, more strikes on the horizon, and Ofsted faces backlash over recent inspections.
Well, it's that time of the month again. It's time for another episode of the Schools and Academy Show podcast, looking at all the biggest stories from April 2023.
Coming up, we'll be joined by Sir Andrew Carter, the CEO of South Farnham Educational Trust, to discuss the possibility of more strikes, the leaked DfE workload report, and calls for Ofsted to be reformed or abolished.
Today's main stories will all have a common through line based around workload and accountability. So with that in mind, where better to start than with the workload document that recently leaked out of the Department for Education to Schools Week?
The report entails the Working Lives of Teachers and Leaders survey of roughly 11,000 school staff, taken in the spring of 2022, recording both how they spent their working week and the effects of workload on their well-being. And, well, to be honest with you, the findings don't look great, even if they likely will come as no surprise to those working in schools.
In 2019, the government made a pledge to reduce teacher workload by 5 hours a week to ensure that they are able to focus on teaching high-quality lessons. However, since then, teacher workload has only fallen by about 48 minutes on average a week.
Over half of the teachers and leaders called their workload unacceptable, with over 40% of leaders working 60-hour weeks and one in five teachers reporting the same conditions.
But just where do all these extra hours come from? Well, over two-thirds of teachers said they spent more than half their working time on tasks other than teaching, with general admin being cited as the main task that took up too much of their time.
Other tasks which were seen as taking up too much time included data recording, behaviour incidents and following up on them, lesson planning and, you guessed it, marking. Whereas for senior leaders, the most cited tasks and taking up their time was responding to government policies.
As a result, over half of those surveyed said that the job was negatively affecting their mental health, and those working in education scored lower across all measures of well-being compared to the general population, including life satisfaction and happiness. In fact, 69% of those surveyed said that they felt the teaching profession was not valued by society.
Combine these factors with the other financial pressures on the sector, causing many staff not to see pay increases, and then perhaps it's not surprising that over a quarter of staff surveyed considered leaving the profession after a year, even though the vast majority enjoyed teaching most of the time.
So those are the key details to come out of the leak. We'll be sure to let you know when the official release of the document comes, but for now it's time for some insight and analysis. So let's throw it over to our guest, Sir Andrew Carter.
Sir Andrew, thank you for joining us. It's always a pleasure to speak with you and it's great to see you. Would you like to introduce yourself to our audience and share a bit about your experience within the sector?
Yes, I'm Andrew Carter. I am the Chief Executive of South Farnham Educational Trust, which is an academy of seven schools, soon to be eight, based in Farnham, Surrey. I've been in education quite a long time and I was involved in the Carter Review. I was the Carter Review of ITT in 2015.
We've had a leaked report from DfE regarding workload, and we know that workload has been a constant discussion for a number of years now within the sector. And one of the statistics that they pulled from it is that 56% of teachers and leaders reported that they do not have sufficient control over their workloads. Now, according to papers from the NFER and the Chartered College for Teaching, we know that autonomy is shown to be linked with job satisfaction and wider well-being. What can be done to give people working in schools more ownership of their workloads in order to sort of reduce stress and address that work-life balance? And I suppose tagged on to that is, what are the other solutions out there that we can use to address heavy teacher workloads?
Yeah, I think workload is quite a big thing. It's difficult to talk about workload. This is the first day back after Easter, and that is always going to be the problem, isn't it? Difficult to talk about a teacher's workload last week or the week before, but we must certainly talk about it today. However, one of the issues in teaching is teachers become obsessed with planning and schools become obsessed with planning. In my own trust, teachers are not expected to work at home in the evenings or at weekends. If a teacher leaves one of our schools with a box of books to mark and the head teacher sees them, the head teacher will go to them and say, "What are you doing?" And if the teacher says, "You might think it's all very easy here, but I have to do this every night," what we have trained our head teachers to say is, "That is our problem, not theirs." We have got to say to them, "I'm sorry. Now, what you have to do is look into it and see if they're working efficiently and cleverly and all of those things." Now, just going back to planning, we have a national curriculum. Every child in the land does maths in the morning, English after break. I mean, it's roughly the same. I visited hundreds of schools. They're all the same. But they like to think they're different. And that's great that they do, because that gives it locality. But teachers are teachers. The key is in the word teachers, not planning. That doesn't mean what we want our teachers to do is to plan how to make it come alive and be exciting. Now, that's different than writing down what they've got to do, because it's pretty well documented how to teach fractions, how to teach history. The curriculum is there, but you get teachers. I mention this to teachers and they almost reach hysteria. "We have got a plan. How can you teach a lesson tomorrow unless you've evaluated today's?" Well, of course, how can you do it? Because that's how it works. There are 1,265 hours in a teacher's year. About 820 of them are in the classroom. You cannot do 820 hours a year and plan each one and spend an hour planning for an hour's work. It doesn't work. So one of the things the schools need to do is to get smart, work with teachers. We have all our planning done. We have it all organized for teachers, but the lessons are great and different because the teacher makes it come alive with more experience. The other thing we need to make sure is that teachers are given permission not to talk in staff rooms about work. On Fridays, we talk to teachers. It's a little technique, and I know this might sound glib, and I really don't want to sound glib. On Fridays, when does a head teacher go to someone and say, "Are you going to the cinema tonight? You're going to the theatre? Are you having a nice meal with your family? What are you doing on Sunday? Going to a football match or whatever it might be?" I've done a lot of teacher training work. And if you talk to trainee teachers and ask them what they expect to spend most evenings planning and often Sunday afternoon. That is ridiculous. And it's something that we as a profession have got to take on board. The other thing, of course, is we may come out of the reviews into teacher salaries at the moment with teachers not getting more money, but having a reduced workload. That could be the balance. But if that work has to be done, someone else will have to do it and we'll have to pay them to do it. And that might be teaching assistants, which are equally as hard to get hold of and earn £10 an hour. And therefore, there will soon be a group that actually are also campaigning for more money that can also affect schools. So we've got to get smart, but we do need to know that teaching is a proper job. We say to school, if a teacher comes in about 8 in the morning, I mean, I don't care whether it's 8, but I'm just giving you broad figures, goes home about 5, 5:30. If they work smartly during that period, there's no need to do much out of school. But there are many who enjoy doing that. I don't mind that. Equally, flexible working. Some teachers want to go home to look after their families or whatever at the end of the day, but also they may be that they decide they want to do a bit in the evening that fits their lifestyle. That's different, but you don't have to. I've been in the profession since the 5th of September, 1971, so I'm not talking from a position of saying, you know, I've done it for a few years. You cannot sustain, it is perfectly possible to sustain working in teaching, but you do have to be realistic. And I think what you have to be able to do, perhaps here is the thing, the statement we say to all our teachers, every teacher should be taught very early on to be able to sustain a high level of insecurity.
Sure, that makes absolute sense. And that leads us on to our next question. The report stated that 2/3 of teachers said they spent too much time working on tasks which were unrelated to teaching. For example, data logging, inputting data, analysis of data, recording behavior issues. And these tie into accountability, and we'll come to Ofsted later. But accountability is a central facet of our education system, fundamentally. It's part of the model that we've chosen. Do you think there needs to be a conversation around initial teacher training and managing the expectations and the tasks associated with the role of teaching?
Oh, absolutely. In teacher training, we've got lots of things. The training curriculum is there with all the subjects you have to do and the pedagogical training. What we don't teach them is how to be a teacher often. And being a teacher, as I say, being able to say, you can never go home as a teacher and say, I've done it. It is complete. My day is done. And that's the insecurity that you need to say to people, that's okay. You will never do it. So what schools need to help trainee teachers and all teachers, and we're all trainee teachers because when they come in, we've got these extensive ECT programs now, is that work out what has to be done, work out what's desirable to be done, and work out what may be done sometimes. So you always do that which needs to be done. And if what needs to be done is after you've taught an hour's maths lesson, if the school has said you must now plan for tomorrow's lesson, you have built into the system failure. What the school should do is, we're teaching fractions this week, here are the four lessons we're going to do, here's the assessment material, now make it come alive. So at the very minimum, the children get a proper coherent plan, and with greater teaching that will come alive even more. And teacher trainees need to understand it. I work with trainees all of the time. I remember when I did my review, going to a university and sitting around a table with lecturers and trainees, and we were having a conversation about how we should become a teacher. And prior to the conversation, whilst everybody's getting their coffee and all that chit-chat, there were two lecturers at the university, I won't tell you which one it is, but who were, one said, oh, I started work at 5 o'clock this morning. I prefer to work from five and go through to about five in the afternoon. And another one said, oh, no, I can't do that. I like a break about 4 o'clock and then I come back to work and through work through till 10 o'clock. I remember saying, what are you two talking about? You're sitting in front of people joining the profession, bragging about how inefficient you are, not bragging about how clever you are. You're bragging about your high level of inefficiency. And to be honest, it doesn't work. And what we also need to do is, and this, again, I have to be careful what I say, but people who tell you they work 12 hours a day are generally talking rubbish. 12 hours a day is 8 in the morning to 8 in the evening without lunch, without coffee, without a bathroom break. Yes, there are people doing that, usually for a lot less money than teachers get. Most teachers don't work those hours. We have a situation at the end of our schools, and this is the smart way you can do it, where all our teachers have a cup of tea at the end of the day, you know, they all get in the staff room, have a chat, and lots of schools do that. What we train our trainees. After a quarter of an hour, go to your classroom, shut the door and start working. Go and do it. If you want to sit in the staff room and chat for an hour and a half, don't you dare come to me and tell me you were working at 7 o'clock at night because it was your fault. So you train in that work style. You have a break, you have a cup of coffee, you go and you work from quarter to four to quarter to six. You've got all your books there, all your stuff. And you go home and have your tea and go to the cinema. And then schools are giving you permission. And then if the school has created something which makes you have to do more than that, then with the school, you can discuss how we can rearrange that work to stop it happening. On every one of the agendas in our meetings in schools, the first idea that comes up, the first agenda item is pastoral issues, because we're dealing with people. And the second one is, how could we improve? And the third one, before we get to the others, is teacher well-being. It comes up at every meeting. So we say, is there anything in this last week that we are not doing smartly enough? Or there is something, here is the big question. I think schools should go through and make a list of those things that have absolutely zero effect on anything. Because there are a number of those things. I've been to staff meetings, and I guess there are a few people listening to this where they've discussed at a staff meeting sports day in a primary school. We're going to have a sports day. And they discuss it, and the PE lead discusses it. And lo and behold, you'll find it was exactly the same as last year's sports day. And yet we've all sat in a room and discussed it. Why aren't we brave enough to say, tell us what sports day is like? If there's anything going to be radically different, we'll have a chat. Otherwise, we just get on with it.
It will have been difficult to avoid the news relating to Ofsted this month, and the name seems to keep appearing over and over again. But before we dive into this story, all of us here at the Schools and Academies Show team would like to offer our thoughts and our deepest sympathies to the family and friends of Ruth Perry, who tragically took her own life following an Ofsted inspection. In light of this tragic news, attitudes towards Ofsted have become more hostile, with many leaders calling for reform or even the abolition of Ofsted. We've also heard of the case of Flora Cooper, an executive head looking to initially bar an inspection team from entering her school site.
During the NASUWT's conference, delegates voted on a motion which didn't mince its words, describing the inspectorate as, quote, a major contributor to the excessive workload and bureaucracy that blights the lives of teachers. Tell me how you really feel. The motion went on to call for Ofsted's abolition.
The NASUWT is not the only union calling for a halt to inspections. The NEU proceeded with an urgent motion during their conference to freeze all inspections until a full health and safety assessment of the inspection system had been conducted. On top of this, there are reports of inspectors resigning due to the potentially damaging impact inspections are having on schools and their staff.
If you've had your fingers in your ears for the last minute or so and couldn't tell, there's certainly some bad blood between Ofsted and the wider sector. Jeff Barton, the General Secretary of the Association of School and College Leaders, quoted in The Guardian, said, "Our schools, colleges and students need a pipeline of great leaders, but it is clear that Ofsted inspections are causing leaders to quit the profession and deter others from stepping up to leadership. If Ofsted is to achieve its aim of being a force for improvement, it must work with leaders and not drive them out of leadership."
Well, Ofsted have responded to this with an announcement from their Chief Inspector, Amanda Spielman, in which she acknowledges the strength of feeling within the sector and announced changes to the inspecting of safeguarding, saying, "Looking at how we can return more quickly to schools who have work to do on safeguarding but are otherwise performing well." Spielman went on to explain measures of how school staff can be supported during meetings with the inspection team. Whilst going further, she said that the one-word grading system would be kept. Ofsted has come under some pressure over the last month. The NASUWT's members have called for the abolition of Ofsted. It's made some news recently with the tragic death of Ruth Perry. We've had one case of a headteacher initially refusing entry to the inspection team. Ofsted's been cited by the NASUWT as a major contributor to the excessive workload and bureaucracy that blights the lives of teachers. Have we hit some sort of watershed moment in the story of Ofsted? And do you see it realistic that Ofsted will experience significant change either before or after the appointment of a new chief inspector?
Well, yeah, and obviously it is absolute tragedy of the head teacher, and our hearts can only go out to that family and that school and to everybody that has been overwhelmed by Ofsted. If you work in a trust, you often see schools that come your way because of a disaster with Ofsted, and it is greatly demoralising for a school. Clearly, sometimes I suspect it's well-founded, but more often than not, it's something which has gone wrong. Ofsted has turned itself into sort of the police force of schools, and I do think that it's lost its way just a little bit here. Once again, I mentioned earlier about the government is going to be re-elected in 18 months' time. This is a great opportunity for Ofsted. Nothing wrong with the current chief inspector, but she is retiring and there will be a new one coming in. And that will be a really difficult task for somebody, because Ofsted, it's lost its credibility really within the system. One of the things it does is changes behaviours. Because schools, you can have your Mockstead now. Someone can come around and pretend they're Ofsted. And then you have to make sure that everybody's got a crib sheet. So they've all got, if they ask you X, then you must say Y and so on. And that's no bad thing at one level, that it sharpens us all up to be responsive and to think. Schools need to think about what they're doing. and write down what works well and keep doing it. Now, if Ofsted could actually tell schools what they're doing well, the difficulty is Ofsted doesn't actually know. And I think that's the problem. They actually don't know what makes a great school. They can see great schools, but it isn't really applicable to other schools. There are some common features. One of the things I think that ought to be taken out of Ofsted is safeguarding. I know that has been spoken elsewhere. Not that you say that and the horror will come over. Everybody will say, oh, you don't care about children. I care about children slightly more than Ofsted, because if a school hasn't been inspected for 10 years, then its safeguarding hasn't been inspected for 10 years, and that's not very good. So I think safeguarding ought to be the responsibility of every school and ought to be done, well, you could do it annually, biannually, you could choose a time. And therefore, school would have to carry with them a certificate of safeguarding, a certificate which was done by approved providers, and the school could pay for it. So if anybody says who's going to pay for that, the school can. We in our schools are local authority, and it's an offshoot of the local authority, do safeguarding surveys of schools for you, evaluations, cost you £500, and then it doesn't tell you you're perfect, but it can point out this is pretty good, but this might be a little bit better. If every school had to have one of those, then if it got something wrong, it won't fail it, unless it was a disastrous thing. Now, once you've taken that out, Ofsted would need to look around. Now, I do think schools need to be measured, and I think society helps to measure. We've got some measures around SATS results and all sorts of other things. However, I do think that Ofsted, they don't want to talk to head teachers because they felt they were bamboozled by head teachers. And yet it is head teachers who are very important because they do comment upon leadership, but they don't want to talk to the leader. So there is some work to be done here. We have schools that haven't been inspected for 10 or 12 years because they're outstanding, and we have some that sort of get it all the time because they're not so good. The new inspector, once again, will need the wisdom of Solomon, but the new inspector will also have to make a very important contribution to see if Ofsted has any purpose anymore, because we're moving to a position where if we all end up being good, I mean, you hear the chief inspector saying all those schools that were outstanding, most of them now aren't really outstanding, they're only good. But they were only outstanding because Ofsted told them they were. It was Ofsted that said they were. So we can't help that. Now, if we're all going to end up with good or failed, that's ridiculous as well. So I think schools ought to be inspected. They ought to look at them with some very general principles. And the general principle is this: do they know what they're doing? Have they got, my term now, an institutional memory? Do they know what works, and have they written it down? And is there evidence that what they're doing works, and therefore they have the capacity to keep doing it and keep improving? Now, if those schools have got that, it will always be good or better. Now, this institutional memory is so important, which is why I mentioned at staff meetings, sit down and say to people, how could we improve? And when somebody says, and it doesn't need to be a huge thing, when a tiny thing would make this school better, get it written down so you can remember it and give it to everybody. So when an ECT comes into your school, they aren't the virgin teacher with nothing on their brain. They come in and sit collectively with the collective wisdom that everybody's been in the school has got. Now, if a school has done that and is thinking, and it has to have some results, you know, which are measured, that could be GCSEs, SATs, phonics, table tests, whatever. If it's got those, then I think that's a good and a great school. I think the difference between a good school and a great school is good schools are doing okay. Great schools do it all the time and remain good. They remain good. And therefore, for the foreseeable future, Ofsted could say, we can't see this school failing because it's got systems to remain good. That makes it outstanding.
So, Andrew, if I could, I'd like to draw upon what you said about leadership. You know, many leaders within the sector are very open about their concerns with Ofsted. Do you think the sector is becoming more adversarial to this form of accountability? And if so, do you see any sort of consequences between Ofsted and the sector locking horns?
Well, yeah, I'm a great believer in not compromise, because that sounds a bit wishy-washy. Locking horns is great, and sometimes you need a bit of a row and it's a lovely thing and let's do it. But to be honest, most of us would go in the other direction. So I think what we should do, and I think Ofsted, the new inspector, would be really wise to listen carefully. We have a situation where working together will be best. Working with trusts would be best. The trust sector, the MAT sector, has been given the responsibility to support very many of the most challenging schools. And they're doing that job pretty well. They're doing it, you know, as good and bad and everything. And I think that the Ofsted inspectors could look at what some of these schools, if a school is inadequate and 3 years later is defined as good, you need to go to that trust, that MAT, and say, how did you do that? How did you do that? What were the things you did? So the institutional memory of a school becomes the institutional memory of the trust, becomes the institutional memory of the country. And actually, locking horns, it rarely works. However, people need to be serious about it, and they need to have proper discussions and listen, because sometimes people think people are cross because they didn't get an outstanding or they didn't get a good. I speak to lots of people in the system who tell me it's the unjust nature of it that upsets them. You are very much at the whim of which inspector you get. And that's an inspector that's coming in looking for good, looking for goodness, is what we should be doing. Let's look what they're be doing that's really good and try and articulate it. And let's make a few suggestions of things we've seen elsewhere that they might like to include. You see, if you go from a school and if a parent sees the school is good or outstanding, it's a bit of a difficult, what does good mean? You know, what does outstanding mean? I know that the Labour Party are very keen on having a report card to have it, but that's equally difficult. Remember what teachers did when they write reports, they in the end moved to the computer one, didn't they? I had a report when I was a child, 13, which says Andrew is a disturbing influence in an otherwise quiet class. Now, wouldn't be allowed to say that now. A computer would be able to identify something different. What we need to make sure is that it's meaningful, because if we don't, this is what will happen. Ofsted will come, people will play the game, people will change their behaviours. And Ofsted, I mentioned earlier, they change their behaviour to get outstanding. Next time they get a good, so they forgot to change, they've got to keep up with Ofsted all of the time. And at the end of it, I suppose Ofsted has got to come to a view, and we all have, what is the purpose of inspection? Now, one of the things is 22% of schools were outstanding and now they're not, or whatever the number is. That's a good statistic, but doesn't mean anything really. So Ofsted, I think this is a great change, a great opportunity, a new inspector, and we as a sector have got to open our hearts, our minds and our souls to joining in that debate.
As you can tell, there's clearly a lot of pressure going on in the teaching profession at the moment. And when pressures rise, things can often reach a breaking point, which often leads to our third story today, which is strikes continuing across the sector.
Addressing strikes seems to be a reoccurring segment on this podcast, but considering that they are a reoccurring segment in our day-to-day lives, there's not really much that we can do about that.
Recently, the NEU overwhelmingly voted against the government's most recent pay offer. This means that there is still room for more strikes in the future, and with exam season fast approaching, there are fears across the board that GCSEs and A-levels could be disrupted.
Currently, walkouts are planned for the 27th of April and the 2nd of May, and at their annual conference, voted for taking further 3 days of strike action in late June or early July.
Given the timing of these strikes so close to exams, though, the NEU will support arrangements that provide what they call the minimum level of teaching staff needed to allow Year 11 and 13 to attend school for supervised revision activities or exam practice. However, the guidance put out by the NEU encourages any teachers who do have to enter school for this reason to leave as soon as their duties for these year groups are over.
NEU documents published ahead of the motion for the summer strike said, "It is vital we plan a programme of escalating strike action, political lobbying and community campaigning that can bring the maximum social weight to bear on the government throughout the summer term and beyond. So it sounds like a new school year won't necessarily be the end of the strikes."
But of course, it's not just the NEU who are currently campaigning for improved teacher pay and working conditions. In the Askell ballot, 87% of members rejected the pay offer, with most referring to the inadequacy of funding for the 4.5% pay rise.
Similarly, 87% of the NASUWT members rejected the pay increase, meaning four unions have now rejected the government's most recent pay offer.
NASUWT also asked members if they are willing to vote for strike action to achieve what they call a fair pay award, and 77% of respondents said they would. So there is a very real chance that we could see strikes from multiple unions together in the future.
Well, you say that, Sam, and in light of the Association of School and College Leaders' recent decision to ballot their members over strike action, this could very well be true. Significantly, this is a historic ballot and the first time the union has done so in their history. Quoted in Schools Week, Jeff Barton, the union's general secretary, said it was clearly a very significant step, but the government had left us with no option other than to conduct a formal ballot for national strike action. Their ballot will be held at some point in the coming term, the possible strike in autumn.
Depending on the outcomes of the various ballots, we could be looking at all four major unions striking. The government has given its offer, it's been resolutely rejected. So where do things go from here? Is there a light at the end of the tunnel?
Well, obviously, before I start, I must actually say I fully endorse the concept of being the ability to strike. You know, I'm not against that at all. Where is this going? I don't know. At the moment, what's happened is that we haven't got more pay, and we don't seem to be in a position where we've raised people's expectations higher in the society. I mean, part of the reason of having a strike, I suppose, is to show that teachers are very important and therefore deserve extra pay. And I'm not sure we convinced everybody of that. Where's it all going to go? I guess what's going to happen is, like with all things, there'll be some compromise. And the compromise will be we'll have to sit down and discuss what is a teacher worth. How are we going to pay them? There are 456,000 teachers, roughly. So any, if you'll give us all one penny a month, that's a lot. You give us 1,000 or 2,000 or whatever it might be, this is a lot of money. So there has to be an affordability to this. And it's very difficult. I think the wisdom of Solomon is needed here. And perhaps the concept of going to the review body for pay is one of the best ways here. But I do think what and the unions need to think about what happens if the review body come up with a figure which is less than the unions want. Do we keep going until such time as they give in? I just think at some point we've just got to accept the position the country's in, try and get as good an offer as we can, and then get on with it.
With the NEU looking to strike on Thursday the 27th of April and Tuesday the 2nd of May, this industrial action will have an impact on multiple stakeholders across the sector. What are the further reaching consequences of these strikes?
The difficulty I think that we have here, we have the moral dilemma, professional dilemma of teachers wanting to do their best by their children, and they do want that. We argue strongly about COVID and the difficulty of lockdown. Children have missed all of this. And then it seems to me increasingly difficult to make that argument and then to go on strike for your own benefit. And I can hear, you know, people throughout the land saying, well, that's a terrible thing to say. The argument seems to finger upon the fact that if you're going on strike, you're doing it for some greater good for education in the country. I'm not sure that's actually what's happening here. If unions get together and if we forced all the unions of all the various groups got together and the government was able in some way to give the 10, 20%, whatever it was, we've got to think is what will happen then? And we have to think really seriously about that, because in reality, what will happen is there will be less money. There is no, you know, the famous no money tree out there. So we'll have less money going into education. Or are we to believe that the government can actually afford this and are deliberately trying to wreck the education system? Now, I don't think that concept is right. I don't think any government is trying to damage the system. They're doing what they're best, what they think is best. I am also, perhaps naively, although I've been around quite a long time, so my naivety is bred of long time in the system. If we believe in democracy, we must at some point, as teachers, leaders in society, the creators of new citizens, we must at some point understand that governments do have, in a democratic society, the right to govern. And we must allow them to do that. And our democratic opportunity comes once every 5 years to do something about it. Unless somebody is being totally unreasonable, and there will be arguments saying this is totally unreasonable. I don't believe that if you gave teachers, an early career teacher, £5,000 a year more, so it'll take their salary up to £35,000 a year, I'm not convinced that will fill the classrooms with teachers. It isn't as simple as that. You do know, and I'm sure that others do, that teaching is still the preferred occupation for people that change their professions. It is, we employ in my own trust lots of new teachers. We have a huge primary skit, 150, 200 trainees, and they come into teaching because they want to do something that is good, to change the system, and we mustn't be cynical of that. And so absolutely they need to be paid well. They have to be paid sensibly, but it does have to be affordable as well. It's interesting, if you look at the private sector that probably does have the capacity to pay more, they generally don't.
So there is parity between the private and the maintained
sector? In general.
Sure, that makes sense. This brings us to our final question. We see that in Northern Ireland, the NASUWT, the NEU, the INTO and the UTU, they're all planning combined strike action on the 26th of April. And that's the first time, and for the first time, they'll be joined by members of the NAHT. Do you see a combined industrial action or combined strike here in England? And do you see further whole school closures as a result of that?
Well, there's the possibility, all things are possible. What do I know? It's interesting, I'm a member of the NEHT, and I'm actually asked to vote this last time. I don't know whether it got lost in the post or something. But anyway, the point being that if we all join together or go on strike, what happens then? What does this tell us? And what is the message to the nation? So I think that people, if you go on strike, it's going to be for a purpose. And the purpose is to get more money. Or people will say, as I spoke earlier, that the purpose is to change the system, to make it better. Or is the purpose, as could be cynically looked at here, to bring down the government? There's no need to bring down the government. They're going to be re-elected or not in the next 18 months anyway. So what's the point of that? What is the point of it? I think that there could well be collectivism. My own experience is that I think less and less teachers will go on strike. And actually, then you've got a dilemma. Who is actually voting for this? Is it a militant few? And I'm not against people going on strike. Please don't, I'm not against that. But just think is, what is the point of it? At the end of it, we are going to get more money as a profession when we're seen as a profession that has a great, total, complete professional commitment to the children in our care. I'm not sure us all grouping together to change this is really going to get any results. It might feel good, but I don't think it actually changes much. And as I say, in 18 months, we will all have our chance to do the voting that really matters. And that may go, who knows, which way? Because I haven't heard yet what the Labour Party are going to pay teachers. What I've heard is they're going to get together in a room and discuss it. Well, we'll wait and see, because they may well be the government. I'm imagining, we all hope, that if it was a Labour government, let us say next time, then they are, first thing they're going to do is give teachers an extra 5 or 10% on top of the 5% that's been offered. Well, my experience is that rarely happens.
Well, Sir Andrew, thank you ever so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it. Do you have any final words for our listeners?
Well, I just think that, like I say, I've been around a long time, and that isn't anything to be hugely proud about, so I'd be lucky about, isn't it? But I think that as a profession, I have always spotted and still spot it, optimism is where the future lies. This is a great profession to spend your time with children, but to let's be optimistic, not spend our time fighting battles about how bad it is, how joyous it is to work with children, to be in schools, to create the future. And yes, there are problems along the way. As I mentioned, there are 20,000 schools, 456,000 teachers. We need 36,000 new teachers every year. Put that into context. It's the same size as the British Navy every year. That's who we recruit. It's huge. And it's hard to do it. So it's not as surprising that it's difficult. Don't let's assume it's easy and we've made a way of making it hard. This is quite difficult, because there's people want to go into the police and want to be nurses, want to be doctors, want to be the other thing. Let's be optimistic and join in every opportunity to support the elected government of the day to make it better, which includes fair and open, robust criticism if that's necessary, but not war.
Well, today's been a jam-packed episode, so we won't keep you for too much longer. Instead, we'll just leave you with an update on Rishi Sunak's plan to make maths compulsory up to 18, a story we covered a while back. We now have confirmation that there'll be an advisory board who will deliver recommendations in July based off evidence from countries with high rates of post-16 provision and feedback from UK employers.
The group will advise on essential content for the 16 to 17-year-olds and the math skills required for both STEM and non-STEM jobs, as well as the maths knowledge to allow young people to manage their own personal finances.
On top of the content, they will also consider the nature of the study, including the number of hours required and how pathways should differ.
There will be a new maths NPQ for primary maths leaders, and the National Maths Hub programme will be extended. We'll actually have a session on the maths hubs at the show next month, so come along to find out more.
Sunak acknowledges that more maths teachers will be required for this provision. But given the current recruitment and retention crises, in light of the fact that recruitment targets have fallen short over the last few years, this could be a massive hurdle for the government to get over.
Fundamentally, these plans are with the aim of tackling an anti-maths mindset, stating that it's all about changing the culture, as the UK is one of the least numerate countries in the OECD, and that the future of the economy relies upon addressing poor numeracy.
And on that note, I think it's just about time for us to wrap up today. We'd like to once again thank Sir Andrew Carter for his time today, and all of you for lending your ears as well. But Alex, if our listeners want to hear even more from Sir Andrew, what should they do?
Well, if you haven't already figured out by now, you can hear Sir Andrew Carter speak live on the subject of the changing nature of schools at the upcoming Schools and Academies show, London, at the XL on May the 17th.
Alongside Sir Andrew, there'll be a cavalcade of other great speakers, including Christopher Russell from Ofsted, Sam Friedman from the Institute for Government, and of course, the Olympic gold medalist Sir Mo Farah.
Make sure you join us next month, as we'll have a very special episode featuring interviews live from the show floor.
And if you're coming to the show already, why not sign up for our hosted leader programme? If you're a senior leader in the education sector, the programme will help you find the best solutions for your institutions at the show and can help cut your procurement time at the show in half. The programme also provides seamless booking of travel and accommodation, as well as personalised support from our team in booking appointments with suppliers. For more information, check out the link in the description.
Well, that's all from us until next month. Schools and Academies Show London is looking like it's going to be a great show, both on and off the stage, so hopefully we'll see you there. Until then, though, It's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me.